Thanks for the privilege, Tony. My name's John Philman. I wrote a book titled Christchurch Massacre, Satanism and John Podesta in May 2019.
So that's just 2 months after this massacre. Interesting title. Could you just briefly explain why you decided to put John Podesta and Satanism in the title? Maybe we could start with John Podesta. Who is he?
Yeah, well, John Podesta was the campaign manager for the Clintons for a long period of time, going right back to when Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas, dealing in over $100 million in drugs with the CIA.
Through MENA airbase.
Yes, that's right. Okay, and so many Americans believe up to 160 people that blew the whistle on the Clintons have been executed, but the police report that they all committed suicide. So John Podesta, all through this period, was their chief campaign manager, responsible for all of this, I believe.
So what connection does he have to the Christchurch massacre then?
He visited the New Zealand government in Wellington 5 days before it actually took place, and most of the symbols on the shooter's guns were symbols that have been regularly used by John Podesta.
Okay, so it's probably worth saying straight away that the unique thing about the Christchurch Mosque massacre was that the whole thing was apparently streamed live on Facebook. There's a video which was then circulating. I certainly at the time was sent a copy of it. Very horrific, and you obviously don't want the public necessarily to watch that. Journalists need to have access to it to assess what really happened. But it's been, that video has now been banned, I think, in New Zealand. Is that right?
Yes, the video and his manifesto that first appeared on the internet has been totally banned worldwide, including New Zealand. And if you're found with a copy, you're facing a 14-year jail sentence.
Well, even for journalists, because obviously these are very important documents for journalists to go through in order to report the crime.
Yes, even for journalists. In fact, a number of people have been arrested. As far as I'm aware, about 20. Those that have claimed that they're innocent are still being held in prison. We know nothing about them. The others that have admitted their guilt, they've largely been tried.
Well, this is incredible that people, ordinary people, citizen journalists and journalists who are investigating this could be criminalised in this fashion. I mean, it has to be set. How long is the video?
Video is 17 minutes long.
And it shows, one of the mosque massacres. Does it show both or one?
Shows one, the Al Noor Mosque. And the reason was that the government that was responsible for the operation using the CIA or agencies of the CIA, they wanted the video to go live stream, but unfortunately the head cam on the shooter's helmet captured at least three of the mind control shooter's handlers.
They do seem like, guides, so that is also worth talking about. But so basically what the video shows, obviously it's, impossible to, and maybe you would think for criminal reasons you wouldn't want people to watch it, but what it shows is basically the guy, it's a video and audio recording from his head cam, so you can hear the shots, you can see him shooting and killing people, sometimes, for example, shooting into piles of bleeding, dying people. I assume it's almost to make sure they're dead. So it's a really horrific video. It starts with him sitting in his car and driving along. Then he pauses by the side of the road. He stops for a little while by the side of the road, and then he carries on down the road into an alleyway with the mosque at the end, and then he gets out, and there's 17 minutes of him killing people, basically, in this video, doing things like going back to the car, taking out more ammunition, getting another. So it's, I mean, even to describe it is quite horrific. But that's basically what's going on with this video. But let's get back to your title again. I can see why some people who maybe have no particular faith could see this kind of attack as satanic, because of course it's a, you know, you're talking about Satanism here. Why did you decide to include that in the title?
Largely because when John Podesta visited the government, and presumably the Prime Minister, head of police, military in Wellington, New Zealand, prior to the operation, I believe he supervised the operation. If you look closely, when he was interviewed by Television New Zealand.
Hang on, was he still in New Zealand at the time of the attack?
I don't know.
So that is just not disclosed and not known. So he would have. But we do know he was here in New Zealand how many days before?
5 days before, okay. Because he was interviewed by Tova O'Brien, a well-known political journalist in Wellington. And when she interviewed him, I picked up that when he opened his mouth, he has got Dracula fangs, and he was wearing a High Priest of Satanism's ring, which is a bright red ruby ring. And so that's what I know a lot about Satanism and the occult, and so that really twigged me. So I did further research. I already knew a lot about him anyway. And so then that's connected to the symbols, the satanic symbols he's used on the shooter's guns.
And what about the manifesto? I seem to remember looking at that and thinking, well, there seems to be Nazi symbols on the manifesto itself.
That's correct. That's a whole different study. But to come back to when apparently they arrested the shooter, he had a number of necklaces with the Order of the Black Sun, which is used in Satanism, on him, and. These are commonly used. John Podesta knows all about it. It's quite well known in the United States. His bastard son, Chester Bennington, main icon that he used was Order of the Black Sun earrings.
Do you want to tell us something about this Order of the Black Sun? What is it?
Well, it's basically Black Sun. This is black representing death in Satanism. And so after the shooter had shot the people in the Al Noor Mosque, he went back to his hopped in his car and turned a video on of called Fire, which is all about killing people in a satanic sacrifice and burning them.
So is that in the video itself, or what?
That is on the video itself.
So it's quite a lot of interesting facts on there that are now apparently in New Zealand a crime to possess, to do with this massacre. So there were two mosques involved. Over 50 people were shot dead by this shooter, the Al Noor Mosque and the Linwood Mosque. But I know that the citizen journalist Vinnie Eastwood, who's a New Zealander, has interviewed eyewitnesses who said that actually that there was simply not enough time for the shooter to actually do the massacre, the 17 minutes we saw in the video, and then get over to the other mosque, the Linwood Mosque, and then to drive away from that and then to be arrested. The timeline simply doesn't fit.
Yes, you've done your research well, Tony. Some witnesses say there were two or three separate shooters in the Linwood Mosque. And
that's the second mosque.
The second mosque. And so if you look at the 17-minute live stream video, that you will see that the shooter has used up all his magazines and relinquished all his guns. So how on earth, including when he opens his boot, and so how on earth can he have left there and driven to the Linwood Mosque to carry out the other shootings? There were three other shooters at the Linwood Mosque.
Okay, so we're looking at a real problem here with the court case coming up for this shooter, the one person who was arrested for this, in that there could potentially be other murderers who were not arrested.
The police arrested two of the alleged shooters, then the rest of them then released them.
There is actually footage, isn't there, of the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, saying that they've arrested three people, I think.
Two or three, I forget which. And so at the same time, the SAS were apparently troops, which are assassination troops linked up to the Australian and British SAS. They just happened to be in Christchurch at the same time. Just highly suspicious. And so really, the people that the police released were actually the shooters.
Well, certainly conjecture. That would be decided hopefully by the courts, and people will come forward with evidence about who they saw. Again, it's been a long delay, hasn't it, for this to come to court? It's over a year, still nothing.
Yeah, well, the court will be a jack-up. Already, everything's been held in a closed court, which basically is a secret court. Nobody is allowed in the public gallery, and any journalists that are allowed in the court are constricted on what they can report. The whole thing is a jack-up. It's scheduled to last 12 weeks, I think, from June to July. So it's just a cover-up.
2020. Yeah. Okay, so also a couple of things in the actual video itself, which are interesting. First of all, the use of a strobe light. You can see that as the shooter is coming into the mosque, there's a flashing light.
I was contacted after I actually wrote the book by an ex-US Navy SEAL, retired, living in New Zealand, who has also worked as a sniper for the US military in the Middle East. And he told me that shooter, whoever he was trained by the US military, because every step that he took from the time he turned his strobe light on, which is used to confuse the enemy, and he carried out the whole system, he shot the people, walked back to his car, got another weapon, and then walked back and put another bullet in all the bodies. That is standard US military training.
And what about these three red figures that you could see? I mean, it's two very, very clearly, one not so clearly. But it does seem as if there are these three red figures. One, very importantly, as he's parked by the side of the road, about to go into the mosque to kill people, he's parked by the side of the road, and it looks as if he's got his left window down, and this red figure, as they pass by, something happens. You can't actually see because he's looking forwards. Maybe he's receiving something from that person through the window, and at which point he then sets off to start the mission. The other of the red figures is just as he's about to turn the corner into the alleyway that leads to the mosque. It almost seems as if that person is marking where this alleyway is. So can you tell us something about these red figures?
Right. Well, there's three that I can see on the video, and this is the reason why they so urgently wanted to take the video off the internet, because they hadn't anticipated that the handlers would have been picked up by his head cam. They're all dressed in red. The first one is a woman, and she, in mind control of these Manchurian candidates, it's well known that they have waypoints or triggers. And so as...
Well, hang on, because in a military operation, you have a similar thing. You'll have somebody who will say, right, after the area has been checked, to actually at the time say, right, go. So in other words, or basically to press the go button on the operation. And then a final person to do that as he's turning into the mosque, that may also be someone who is in radio contact with someone somewhere else and saying, right, it's okay, the operation is on. Because, you know, as we know, if there's something unexpected in the area, the operation may be cancelled at the last minute and it may be a walkaway. So, in other words, he just drives off and nothing happens.
Yeah, when he stops and before he commences to drive to the Al Noor Mosque, a woman dressed in bright red approaches him on the footpath, and she actually sets the course in motion, and then
That's right. So he then literally, as she is there, just after she passes his car, walking down the pavement, that's when the mission starts. That's he's sitting there waiting, and then he's off. But the recording started before that.
That's correct. And then the second waypoint is when he is to turn up this very narrow lane that's next door to the Elnor Mosque to park his car, and there's another handler dressed in a bright red jumpsuit, very tall man. The shooter turns around and looks back as he's walking further away from him, and if you look closely, he's wearing US special weapons assault team tactical boots. And that was confirmed to me by the ex Navy SEAL sniper that saw me subsequent to writing the book. And so he was one of the handlers, and so he had to reverse his car back to actually drive up the lane to park the car before going into the mosque.
Reversed his car? I thought he drove forwards down there.
I thought he overshot the lane and then reversed back and then drove down there.
Right, so what about the third symbol or person? It looks as if they're stood against the wall in the garden, quite distant from the action.
Yes, when he walks into the mosque the second time to put a bullet in the bodies, standard US military practice, when he walks out of the entrance towards the road, he turns his head around to very quickly sideways, and if you slow the frames down, you can see a man dressed in, one of his handlers dressed in red against the wall of the boundary of the mosque. That is, if you're standing out on the road looking at the front door of the mosque, it's on the right.
Okay. So, I mean, would these people have been potentially shot by him?
They could have potentially been shot by him. That's why they're dressed in red.
Well, what's the significance of the red then?
Well, the red is, it relates back, this is the colour they've chosen in the mind control programming. Also, it's linked up to John Podesta's, you know, including the song Fire in the live stream video.
Okay, so these gun symbols, let's go back to them. You say that they are linked to Podesta. There's lots of scribbling and writing and some symbols. Can you just pull that apart at all?
Okay, you'll see in some of the guns, number 14, fish symbols, you know, this all relates back to Chester Bennington, the bastard son of John Podesta, whose star sign was Pisces, and linking up to his birth date and so on. That's why it's, and the reasons why a number of people believe that Chester Bennington was, well, the police claim he committed suicide, but he was killed by John Podesta, was that they were going to blow the whistle on John Podesta's paedophilia.
The other thing to note about the video is that it's a rather like one of those shoot 'em up games. In fact, I mean, I don't play them myself, but a lot of people do, where you have a kind of screen of the wherever you are, maybe it's outside, maybe it's an internal picture of being inside a room or something, and all you see really in the game is a gun shooting at people. And there is something quite uncannily similar between this video of these people being shot and a video game. Basically, this is the sort of thing that millions of young, mostly boys, play every day.
Yeah, well, basically, around New Zealand, I would say the majority of the school kids have seen the video. In fact, I know of headmasters in schools near where I live have actually lectured all their pupils against watching the video, which the kids have already seen. And most of the kids say that the live stream video is actually not very violent at all compared to the video games that they watch on a regular basis.
And what about the actual guns used? Do we know anything about them?
Guns are special weapons, assault weapons. As far as I'm aware, AR-15, .223 assault weapons used by the military and police.
So this, you say .22, that doesn't sound like a very high calibre.
.223, Yeah, they're
what's the significance of having quite a small caliber bullet rather than you know what you would expect? A small caliber bullet wouldn't be killing so many people.
Yeah, no, well, those particular bullets, they travel at a very fast velocity over 3,000 feet per second, but they're a relatively light bullet, about 45 grains, and they don't make a lot of outward damage as do the heavier calibers, but they're the preferred caliber of the US military.
What, for this sort of operation or generally in the battlefield?
In the battlefield, they're also used by the police because you can carry a lot of bullets and they're not so heavy, and yet they're devastating.
The gunman was also quite well travelled, wasn't he?
He was well travelled, but he the people that worked at the gym where he used to live in Grafton, New South Wales, couldn't understand that he was like what he was and capable of shooting people, because they considered he was a normal people. His parents considered he was normal, and yet in Grafton, New South Wales, is a prison town with a military presence, with a big a hospital and a department of a psychiatry there. And so, you know, I believe that the Australian military have got to him in Grafton, because when he finally came to New Zealand, he went to Dunedin, where is the location of New Zealand's biggest medical school. And in the department of psychiatry in the school is a chap who is an Israeli who also works for the Israeli military, which is very suspicious, but I can't prove it.
So he was based here in Dunedin in New Zealand, but he was originally from Australia. What other countries did he visit? Because we know that he did seem to have sort of obsession with guns and the military, and we suspect that maybe he was working very closely with the military or private military companies.
Well, the media has told us that he's visited a number of countries, including Israel. You know, I take that with a grain of salt. I look more at, you know, where he come from in Grafton, and then spending time in Dunedin. It's almost a repetition of Martin Bryant in the Port Arthur massacre in Australia, which was used to take firearms off the Australians. Basically, Martin Bryant was a patsy. He never carried out the shootings. It was the Australian military. And, you know, Martin Bryant just happened to be under the care of Dr. Eric Cunningham Dax in Melbourne, who was linked to the Tavistock Institute in London, whose representatives brought the CIA's mind control programs to the United States. So okay. It's all interlinked.
So the motive, this is the big question, isn't it? I mean, it seems to have had a big effect here in New Zealand. The war on terror up until the Christchurch massacre was something which happened a long way away, wasn't it?
Yeah, the motive is twofold. Firstly, to remove firearms from the general public.
It's worth mentioning that if you look at the video, if any of these people in the mosque had had a gun, this shooter probably wouldn't have gotten away with it.
Yeah, that's true. The whole thing has been coordinated by the United Nations Office for Disarmament Affairs global plan to disarm all private citizens. The New Zealand government is tied up with it real thick.
Okay, so what's been the effect here in New Zealand?
Well, the effect is, it hasn't been announced yet, but it's coming within the next 6 months.
There was immediately a ban on assault rifles, am I right?
Oh, sorry. The government has immediately banned assault rifles, had a buyback of all semi-automatic weapons with magazines greater than 10. However, there are new gun laws being developed right now, to be introduced within the next 6 months, that, you know, which will involve the registration of firearms and so on, and far more stringent rules on owning firearms.
Okay, so what about the aspect of, you know, we've seen the war on terror in New Zealand on the television, we've heard about it on the radio, read about it in the newspapers, but it's not actually here. Of course, now after the Christchurch massacre, it is here in New Zealand.
Yes, well, you know, I mean, the whole objective of the United Nations Department of Disarmament Affairs is to remove all firearms from the general population, because what they have in mind for the world is a dictatorship.
What about the mosque angle on all of this, the fact that it's Muslims? Now, obviously, we've seen many Muslim countries being attacked, invaded. You know, obviously, places like Afghanistan, many countries in the Middle East, which are predominantly Islamic. What's going on with the Muslims, and why the mosque as the place which was targeted?
Yeah, well, the whole aim is to attack Jewish synagogues, Christian churches, mosques, and so on, and blame right-wing extremists. Usually they're people that are whistleblowers speaking against, you know, the New World Order and planned world dictatorship that's just around the corner, to eliminate checks, eliminate cash, introduce a one-world currency, and...
But why are Muslims a target? Well, I mean, surely if there's a one-world currency, they'll have to use it too.
Yeah, well, that's right. But the only people that they hate are the right-wing, what they call as right-wing extremists, usually fundamentalist Christians or civil libertarians.
So, fundamentalist Christians, what do you mean by that? Because there are all sorts of different beliefs. Christians would probably call themselves fundamentalist, Bible-believing Christians. Some are very pro-Israel, some are very anti-Israel, for example.
Well, that's true, but by and large, almost not 100% of these people believe Revelation 13, verses 6 to 8, 16 to 18, prophesies about a global system where... financial system where no man will be able to buy or sell without a mark in his right hand or in his forehead.
Well, there's a much bigger agenda in Revelation, isn't there? The idea of a sort of world government and what they call the tribulation, which is a very, very difficult time for the world. But let's get back to the mosque itself. And this chap, Amen Bagami, I think his name is, from the mosque. He blamed the Israeli government, the Israeli Mossad for it. I mean, did he have any actual evidence for that?
Well, no. As far as I'm aware, those were his suspicions.
But who is he? I mean, what's his position of seniority? Is he from specifically one of these mosques, or does he have a wider position in New Zealand?
I'm not sure. I think he's the imam, head of the biggest mosque in New Zealand, based at Mount Roskill in Auckland.
Finally, then, let's look at the court case, because this is where much of this is going to come out. It's amazing that we're a year on and still nothing has really been tested. None of this evidence has been tested in the courts. It's really only the media that's had a chance to look at it, and much of that, of course, has been stifled by the legislation stopping journalists possessing, in fact criminalising the possession of the evidence that's already out there from Facebook. So what's happening with the court case, and how do you expect that to go? I know you said it's all going to be a fixed up court case, but what are we expecting?
Okay, you brought out the second point we should have mentioned. The first point is to get rid of military-style weapons. The second point is to close down free speech on the internet. In other words, if you criticise any government agent or agency, that's considered to be hate speech or right-wing extremist. Doesn't matter whether you're criticising vaccinations, the police or whatever. Now, the court trial... prior to this, the New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern introduced what is now called the Christchurch Call, that's brought together the heads of Facebook, Google, YouTube, all these big internet providers in the world to formulate a standard process to censor the internet. So I believe that because the trial has been scheduled to last for 12 weeks, that the trial is going to be used by the global media to actually further strengthen the close down of free speech. And incidentally, the trial will be a closed court. So the members of the public or independent journalists will not be able to report on it.
Can you tell us about the wider agenda in New Zealand? I know you think that actually the civil liberties are being quietly, but slowly, consistently eroded here.
Absolutely. New Zealand, really, they're calling for submissions now on a bill relating to sexual abuse cases where they want to pass this bill which will allow complainants the ability to choose not to appear in court, to be cross-examined by the defendant, which is really outrageous. The Commissioner for Children recently, a week or 2 weeks ago, announced on television that he's a former judge. He wanted to abolish the right to silence over sexual abuse cases, mainly Maori parents that won't give evidence. So in British law, the right to silence is considered to be a pivot of innocent until proven guilty, and that it's the onus is to be on the Crown to prove somebody is guilty of an offence. That is under threat.
Hey, can you just tell us which specific court cases is this involved in? Because I know that there's actually very politically charged cases where people have who have been critical of the government have been charged with rape. So for their accusers not to have to give evidence or not to be named, not to be identified, it sounds particularly suspicious. So can you just take us through these cases?
Okay, well, back in February last year...
That's 2019.
Yeah. 2019, yeah. Laurie Drew, the main whistleblower for Pike River Mine, the murders at Pike River Mine, he was arrested by the police and has been kept in custody in Christchurch Men's Prison. He has had about five or six pre-trial hearings.
So hang on, how was he involved in the Pike River Mine disaster? You better remind us, that was where there were a lot of people trapped in a mine and the emergency services didn't go in. They had some sort of health and safety problem with going in to rescue people. So what was his involvement, Laurie Drew, with this incident?
Well, Laurie Drew was interviewed on the television shortly after the first explosion.
So was he there as an eyewitness?
No, but his son was one of the 29 victims killed in the mine. And he believed that a cover-up was taking place because Police Superintendent Gary Knowles was brought in to take over and they wouldn't allow the rescuers in to rescue people that were alive waiting to be rescued inside the mine.
So the father of one of the victims of the Pike River Mine disaster is now in jail. How old is he?
I would say he'd be in his 70s, and he's been kept on remand under custody in Christchurch Men's Prison. At this point, March 2020, the only real whistleblower left that claims the Pike River Mine was a cover-up by the government police is a chap called Laurie Drew, who lost his son in the explosion in the mine. He was one of the 29 miners. And so the government, present government we've got, which is a coalition Labor Greens government, part of their election promises were to re-enter the mine, which they're now doing. They've spent somewhere, you know, between $30 and $100 million in the process. They're not finished, but they want to have final closure before the next election. So the only real whistleblower upsetting all this has been Laurie Drew. So they had the police arrest him in February 2019 on trumped-up charges for historical rape, apparently of raping two women over 50 years ago, and have held him in Christchurch Men's Prison ever since on remand under custody, and they haven't even set a date for his trial yet. So, I mean, it's the whole thing is outrageous.
I would imagine that most people would think it was pretty shocking that the father of someone that died in the mining disaster has actually been targeted in this way. There is another case, though, isn't there, which is to do with a murder of a family. Another situation where child sexual abuse charges have been thrown at somebody. So this is, I mean, the incredible thing about some of this is that the accusers are not actually going to go to court, or they may even not be named. So can you just explain, how can that be a court case where the person who is the key witness doesn't appear in court and isn't even named in court?
Okay, well, in the case of Laurie Drew, he's had about five or six pre-trial hearings. A lot of the complaints, apparently, that the police claim that were given to them have proven to be inaccurate or false. And so, consequently, they haven't even set a date for his trial. Now, the other person that was charged, apparently, or with similar complaints, also in February 2019, was a chap called Arthur Allen Thomas, who was wrongfully convicted for killing Mr. and Mrs. Crewe, and later found out that he was set up. The police falsified a lot of the evidence. There were planted cartridges and that to set him up. He was subsequently released from prison. The government paid him out nearly $1 million. But the family, since then, want to get the police to reopen the trial, because with advances in DNA technology, they can prove who actually killed the Drews. And the police, because the police won't open up the case, just filed charges against Arthur Allen Thomas, now in his 80s, for sexual abuse or rape by two other complainants. So they've let him off on bail at present.
Well, I would suggest to you that there may be that police could be facing jail over the falsification of the original case against him. So perhaps that's why this guy has been targeted in that way. But anyway, let's just move on to the present. And we've got, coming up soon, we've got the trial of the shooter of the Christchurch Mosque. How is that case being dealt with?
Well, apparently, according to the newspapers, that case is going to be conducted either in June through to July. It's expected to last 12 weeks. So far, everything that's been held in, when he's appeared in court, has been a closed court, which is a secret court, where no members of the public are allowed in the public gallery, and if there are journalists there, they are accredited journalists and they're told what they can say, and if they say anything other than what they're instructed to say, it's contempt of court. So the whole thing is a kangaroo court.
Can you give us an idea of the sort of things that might come out if it was a public court and if this was a fair trial?
If it was a fair trial, there are members of the public sitting in the public gallery that can hear the evidence that's presented from both sides, from the defendant as well as the Crown.
But what sort of evidence might come into court that might prove embarrassing?
Well, the sort of evidence that could come into the court is that he was obviously not acting alone. It was a military operation, and he might start talking about his military mind control handlers.
There's also the possibility, of course, that figures that are in the film may be discussed. And I suppose the other thing is that you've got particular people who've seen what they say is other people at another mosque. This is going to have to be an enormous cover-up, it seems, this court case. And that's maybe why it's being held in secret. But, I mean, does that fit with the law here in New Zealand? Is it okay? Are the prosecutors allowed to hold a case like this in secret? Because it does seem to me as if there can't be public confidence in such a case.
Well, whether it's lawful or not. That's what they're doing. Closed court is exactly that. It's a secret court. Even the Nazis in Nazi Germany didn't have these secret courts at to this extent.
Anyway, your book is Christchurch Massacre, Satanism and John Podesta, John Philman. Could you just tell us how we can get hold of that book, or how we can read it and print it out? Is it, what form is it in, and where can we find it?
Yeah, it's posted on the internet on an American website called Genuine Christianity. Just Google the title of the book at present. It's there. You can download it for free. And just before I go, I think that the trial that's scheduled for June and July, being 12 weeks, it'll probably be used by the global media as a propaganda tool to further close down free speech.